Just one moment until the courtroom clears. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Laura Vinard, and I represent the appellant, Jaime Contreras-Cisneros. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The facts of this case fit squarely within the Bartkus exception, so that a failure to apply the exception in this case would make a mockery of the dual sovereignty doctrine, to borrow a phrase from United States versus Liddy. The state in this case clearly acted as a tool or a cover for the federal government. Both the government and the district court have propounded two arguments against application of the Bartkus exception. The first argument is an attempt to distinguish between the state prosecution as compared to the state, or I should say the DEA investigation. And the government argues that the DEA and the U.S. Attorney's Office were not involved in the prosecution. But I would ask the court to look at the comments of Judge Ware during the district court proceedings prior to the issuance of his ruling, where he observed that the government did not need to commandeer the state prosecution. Once the DEA orchestrated the wall-stop procedure and then handed over the case, withholding significant evidence from the state actors, there was nothing more that the DEA or the federal government needed to do to control the outcome of the state case. That exemplifies the level of control that the federal government exercised. And I think one point the court can consider was the comment of John Glang, the U.S. attorney, during the district court proceedings, that if the state case had ever reached a point where there was a risk of disclosure of the DEA's involvement, the federal government, quote, might very well have instructed the state court to dismiss its case. That exemplifies the level of control, because the federal government was only handing over this case to the state insofar as it served the federal government's interest. The second point that the government and the district court have made is that the outcome here should be controlled by prior decisions of this court and others with respect to the dual sovereignty doctrine.
Do you have any cases in which the exception to the Bartkus rule has been applied?
Well, in fact, this is an issue of first impression. And
well, it's been here for about 50 years.
Not on the facts that we have.
No, I didn't say whether the exact facts have arisen before. I said, because you said it'd make a mockery of the exception. If in 50 years there hasn't been an exception, that would appear to have been done already.
Your Honor, I would say not, because there has been no case in which evidence was actually concealed from the state actors or the defendant. This is the only case where the adversarial process was actually undermined by the manner in which the case was handed off to the state authorities. The closest case the government has relied on and the district court relied on extensively would be Figueroa Soto. But in that case, the defendant was well aware of the federal government's involvement throughout his case. The DEA agent sat at the prosecution table. The DEA agent testified. There was no concealment of evidence regarding the DEA's prior investigation. And in fact, this court took pains to point out that the DEA provided all information about its investigation to the state authorities.
But excuse me, counsel, the Bartkus exception is extremely narrow. If we follow your reasoning, aren't we basically overruling the rule?
Your Honor, absolutely not.
Sovereignty. Well,
absolutely not.
I hate to use the floodgates argument, but then any arrest would fall within your exception.
No, any arrest where the DEA or a federal agency conceals relevant, potentially material evidence from the state actors when it hands off the case.
Even though there's a valid reason for the arrest, despite that.
Well, Your Honor, the defense was entitled under Brady to any potentially exculpatory material. And there actually is a question with respect to whether the traffic stop was valid. That wasn't an issue that we were able to litigate in my district court case because the court found that we weren't getting into traffic issues. But Mr. Contreras in the state case could have challenged the officer's credibility with respect to the reason for the stop. He claimed that Mr. Contreras sped up to 51 miles an hour in a heavily trafficked zone at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in a span of about 1/8 of a mile. Mr. Contreras could have attacked the officer's credibility because, in fact, his police report falsely stated that he noticed a van speeding without implying or giving any information that he had been tipped off by the DEA. He then testified at the preliminary hearing, giving no indication that he was put in that location by the DEA with information about the drugs in his van. So his credibility was directly on the line, and the fact that he concealed that information could have been used by Mr. Contreras if it had been known. The second aspect that was concealed from Mr. Contreras was exculpatory information about his role. One of the DEA agents testified that they saw him as a courier. And I would submit that Figueroa Soto would have come out differently if there had been concealment of evidence in Figueroa Soto.
Well, why don't you have a Brady claim, then?
Your Honor, we can't pursue a Brady claim against the state authorities. That conviction is over. And so at this point, we are left with a federal prosecution going forward where Mr. Contreras' guilty plea in the state case would likely be piece one of the evidence against him in any federal case.
Well, you could in a habeas case.
He's already served the time. And that is part of the concern with a double jeopardy analysis is the concern of multiple punishments. The 3-year term is over. So there is nothing he can do to get that time back. One aspect of the double jeopardy analysis is looking to whether multiple punishments are appropriate and whether multiple convictions are appropriate. He's got one conviction. He's served one sentence. He can't get that back. So I would ask the Court to look, for example, at Figueroa Soto, which was the most compelling case to the district court. Let's imagine the DEA had an exculpatory witness, and the DEA did not disclose that information to the state in transferring the case over to state prosecution. The DEA agent sat at the prosecution table. The DEA agent testified. No information about this exculpatory witness was ever disclosed, and the reason the DEA handed the case off was to conceal that exculpatory witness, which only came to light when the case was prosecuted federally. I think this Court would not have allowed a second prosecution to go forward, because what you have there is not dual sovereignty. What you have there is the federal government manipulating the state case to serve its own purposes, using the state as a tool and cover to protect some aspect of its investigation from being revealed during disclosure in the state proceedings. And that is exactly what we have here, an informant that was concealed, co-conspirators that were concealed, and evidence about what the DEA believed Mr. Contreras' role to be. So this is not simply like the other double jeopardy cases where the federal government had an interest in having a state case go first.
When did you find out all of this stuff that you now say has been concealed?
I received the DEA reports, and I compared them to the police officer's investigative report. And I discovered and noted that the DEA report did not give any indication that the DEA asked Sergeant Moore to make the stop. What you have is the DEA conducting an extensive surveillance operation, and suddenly their prime suspect is arrested by a local officer in the field. It seemed absurd to me that the DEA would let the suspect get away unless they'd had some role in having that officer make that arrest.
That makes it a sham? The state prosecution a sham?
I have not argued that it's a sham. I'm arguing that it's a tool and a cover. A tool, one that is used to make or manipulated. A cover, something that conceals or obscures.
So when you say it's a tool, what did the federal government get from this?
The federal government was able to conceal its informant from the state actors as well as Mr. Contreras so that Mr. Contreras had no opportunity to attack the informant until such time as the DEA's investigation was closed, so it was not concerned about revealing the informant. Same with respect to the co-conspirators. The DEA did not want to reveal information about the co-conspirators, including Reyna Madrigal, who's the person who allegedly runs this operation out of Mexico. And so the DEA wanted to maintain secrecy about those aspects of its investigation until such time as it had completed its investigation. We might have a different scenario if the DEA had actually disclosed those things to the state actors, but they too were in the dark. So the reason they acted as a tool is because they were never in a position to exercise independent judgment, and they simply functioned as automatons using a case essentially handed to them on a silver platter. To borrow the language of the earlier Fourth and Fifth Amendment cases, finding improper collusion between federal and state authorities.
And that makes this double jeopardy.
Your Honor, it means that the dual sovereignty doctrine should not apply. It means that the double jeopardy doctrine should apply on its face. The dual sovereignty provisions should not apply because the Bartkus exception shows that the federal government used the state as a tool and cover.
Okay. Thank you. You have a minute for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
You're doing a good job.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Valliere on behalf of the United States.
Good morning.
We would ask that the Court dismiss this appeal because there's no valid or colorable double jeopardy claim. And before I start address the dual sovereignty doctrine, I think it's important for the Court to understand that in this particular case, the double jeopardy clause is generally implicated when there are different when the defendant is prosecuted for the same offense twice. Here, the state prosecution was for possession with the intent to sell methamphetamine. The federal prosecution is for conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. As the Supreme Court has said, and as this Court has said repeatedly, the conspiracy to commit an offense and the substantive offense are different offenses. And therefore, under clear case law, the double jeopardy clause is not even implicated in this case, and you need not even go to the dual sovereignty doctrine. This, I think, was raised before the district court, and for reasons are not clear to me on the record, the district court never resolved this question, even though it had been raised by the government that the double jeopardy clause was not even implicated. So our first argument is that the Court should dismiss for lack of jurisdiction because these are just separate offenses. And I think it's important to note as well as the government did not charge the substantive offense in the federal case. It merely charged the defendant with conspiracy.
Is it the same conduct?
It is the same conduct, Your Honor. However, of course, it's the Blockberger test that applies. It's the separate offense test that applies, not the same conduct offense, for purposes of the double jeopardy analysis. So this is not a colorable claim as a matter of law. But even if the Court were to conclude either that the government has waived this in some way or go on to determine that it does have jurisdiction to decide the question of the dual sovereignty doctrine, I think it's important, of course.
Excuse me, counsel. Let me interrupt you before you go on.
Okay.
On the question of jurisdiction, hasn't the Court held that the defendant need only raise an argument with some validity? Are there any cases on point that would say that this claim would not amount to having some validity?
I think the strongest case for the government, of course, is either United States versus Hickey, which basically describes what some validity means. But I think that some validity means it has to have legal validity. In this particular case, United States versus Felix, which is a Supreme Court case, has held that a substantive offense is different from a conspiracy, as well as United States versus Ocasio in this court has held that a conspiracy is different than the substantive offense. So before you even get to discussing the different sovereigns involved, you have to resolve the question for yourself that these are different, whether or not these are the same offense. And I think the case law quite clearly establishes that they are not.
All right, thank you.
But going on to the argument that my opponent has made here this morning, the district court had a full hearing in this case, which I think is important, and made factual findings as well as came to conclusions based on that hearing regarding whether or not the Barkas exception applied on these facts. The Barkas exception is very narrow, as the court has earlier indicated, and it applies when essentially the dual sovereignty is a sham or a tool, or there's been a breakdown between the two sovereigns so that they've almost melted into one. Here, the district court, after a full hearing, made four significant findings. It first felt that the DEA did request the surveillance. I don't think there's any dispute of that the DEA asked the state operators to survey this particular white van and to, if they developed independent probable cause, to stop the van. And the court concluded that the state police had stopped the car for traffic violation for speeding. The court also found, quote, no federal involvement in the state prosecution of the defendant other than this oral request. The court went on to find that after arrest, there was no subsequent federal involvement in the state prosecution and no communication between the two sovereigns after the DEA's initial request. And finally, what the court found, and again, this is after a full hearing, and this court reviews those factual findings for clear error, the court found that the evidence in this case simply suggests that state and federal enforcement authorities cooperated with each other, which this court has concluded in Figueroa de Soto and many other cases is perfectly permissible. And I can go on to say that the record here, since you're reviewing for clear error, unequivocally demonstrates and supports the district court's conclusion. First, the evidence shows that the DEA simply made the request. The agents, Special Agent Morjon, testified that she requested and asked the state police officers, Sergeant Moore in this case, to make a stop because they did believe that there may be drugs in that van, but that indeed they did not want to interrupt their investigation because they had an informant. Sergeant Moore and the other special agent, Ficoccio, both corroborated Special Agent Morajan's testimony that she both requested the stop and that the state officer had to develop independent probable cause. Second, it's undisputed that there was no contact at all between the agencies after the defendant was arrested. The testimony was clear from all of the agents that on the day of the arrest, that was the last contact between the DEA and the state officials.
So the decision to institute the prosecution, the charges that were prosecuted, and the conduct of the trial, there was no communication?
Yes, Your Honor. I want to correct. The defendant pled guilty in state court, so there was never a trial.
The negotiation of the plea.
But, yes, that was actually my next point, which is there was absolutely no evidence that the federal officials, the DEA, ever directed anything with regard to the state prosecution. There was no discussions regarding which charges to bring. There was no discussion about what disposition there should be. There was no request by the DEA that the state officials actually keep this wall stop or its wall stop under wraps in the state court proceedings. There was a request, certainly on the day of the arrest, that they not reveal the DEA's involvement. But given that there's no communication between the two parties, between the DEA and the state officials, all the way up to the time of the preliminary hearing and thereafter, it's hard for the defendant to meet its burden of showing that request that the informant be kept silent at the preliminary hearing was made on behalf that the DEA actually made that request. There was no communication. The state officer did testify that he did keep it out of his reports and that when asked the question that he did inform the DEA before the preliminary hearing in the state court that in fact he was that there had been this DEA involvement, and in fact the DEA told him at the time, if you're asked the question, answer it honestly. He wasn't asked the question during the hearing. The evidence also supports here, and I think this is important for the dual sovereignty doctrine, that there was an independent state interest here. I mean, part of the problem was that the DEA at the time was conducting this larger investigation or surveillance. They knew that the drugs might be taken out of the area, and rather than blow their entire cover, they contacted local law enforcement, San Jose, to make the stop, and essentially, if they could develop independent probable cause, which there was no dispute they had, then in fact, to proceed however they would proceed, but they would prefer prosecution in state court. The state officials certainly had an interest in prosecuting the defendant because he was traveling in the streets of San Jose with about 12.5 pounds of methamphetamine. And this evidence also shows that state interest, the vindication of that state interest, did not vindicate in any way the federal interest. The federal interest here was in prosecuting the broader conspiracy, which is what he's charged with now. And that broader conspiracy included additional conduct on the part of the defendant, as well as a broad conspiracy that stretched from not only through Mexico all the way up through California. So the bottom line is essentially that there was no evidence to support that this was a sham tool or a cover for a separate federal prosecution, and so therefore the defendant failed to meet the Barkas exception. But I want to address it with my few minutes left. The claim in the state court that somehow that the defendant was precluded because something was concealed from him in the state court, from that is an independent basis for the court to conclude that there's a double jeopardy violation. Again, the court here is not writing on a blank slate. In United States versus Lewis, this court specifically said that you cannot litigate a Brady claim in the context of a double jeopardy challenge. Secondly, of course, procedurally, the defendant does have a right to go back and challenge his state prosecution if he believes that something was concealed. Even though he's now out of prison, he can challenge the prosecution itself. Third, substantively, there's no reason, and I've seen no case law to actually even suggest that the defendant was entitled to this information before a preliminary hearing. And if a full-blown Brady analysis were done, substantively, it's clear that it was not material to the question at the preliminary hearing anyway, which was probable cause. Also, I have to say that there's nothing theoretically that keeps the defendant from moving to suppress the evidence in federal court if he believes there's a challenge to the stop and the legality of the stop on Fourth Amendment grounds. I think it's going to be tough, considering that the district court has now concluded that there was in fact a traffic stop and that never really was
entitled to a dismissal of the indictment.
It's not tied at all. But also, just one more thing, Your Honor, and that's with regard to the role of the defendant. It is not true that the DEA concluded that he was a mere courier. The agent who testified, and this is at excerpts of record 172, 2B, said that he may have been Mir Courier, but he could have been Pablo Escobar, for all we knew.
On your first point about you're charging him with a conspiracy, the indictment charges him with other counts in addition.
No, Your Honor. It charged this defendant only with a conspiracy count.
Okay.
Thank you.
Briefly.
Well, first let me say that I'm very surprised to hear the government make a Blockberger argument, which was not litigated in the district court, was not presented in the government's brief here. It has not been litigated by either party. It has been waived. It's not appropriate for decision. And regardless of that, it is another aspect of the control that the government exercised, because the state court could only charge a case with the hands it was dealt. The state court was not dealt a hand that included the names of, or identities of co-conspirators. So all the state could charge at that point was the single defendant who was in the car. Now the DEA is willing to release information about the co-conspirators, so they're charged in a larger case. So that, again, goes to the way that the state case was manipulated for the benefit of the federal government. The government has not addressed the fact that the adversarial process was essentially undermined by the concealment of this information during the state case. The government, as it did earlier, attempts to shift blame to the state actors. But as Judge Ware found during his comments in the district court, the state actors were all operating under the same approach to try to assist the DEA and try to maintain the secrecy about the DEA's overall investigation. They were not putting their own reputations on the line. They were not acting as rogue officers or rogue district attorneys, doing these things for their own benefit.
All right. We do understand your position.
Thank
and
you, Your
used
Honor.
Your time. The case just argued is submitted, and the court appreciates the quality of argument on both sides.